pick up with a small point from a question that came to me at the break that's probably worthy of spending a few moments on. Look in Daniel chapter 2 a moment again. Having stressed enough, I think, that you understand my position that, you know, Nebuchadnezzar's image represents a one-world empire of a lot of different nations joined together in one purpose at the time of the end, and stressing the fact that, you know, all of our views on what's happening in the world around us have to fit into that picture. It is important to note how that image is destroyed, because Brother Asbel came up and did ask me a good question that, particularly for the younger Bible students, this is probably good to go over real fast. Daniel chapter 2, verse 34. Thou sawest that a stone was cut out without hands, which smote the image upon his feet, that were of iron and clay, and break them to pieces. Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken to pieces together, and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away, that no place was found for them. And the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. Well, I do want to say that there's really two portions to this that need to be paid attention to. First of all, the stone smites the image. It's hit on the feet. The image then falls. And then there is a grinding of that image to powder so that it blows away like the summer breeze. And that's I think the import of that statement is this. When we look for this conglomeration of powers in the last days to join together to form the image, we can look at Daniel 2, Daniel 7, and Daniel 8, where Brother Sid took us yesterday, particularly through chapter 7 and 8, and talking about the ecclesiastical elements as well as the political civil elements of the Roman power. We can see from those chapters, Daniel 7 and 8, that there's going to be this religious influence in this image power as well as political. After the image is smitten and it falls to the ground, it still has to be ground up to powder. And that's not going to happen immediately. We've made a point about territories, not races. We still, after the image is knocked down, we still have to destroy Babylon the Great. And somebody just shouted out. Normally, when we think of Babylon the Great, apocalyptically, we're talking about what institution? I didn't hear it very well. Okay, thanks. I did hear some answers, but because there was two or three people at once, my ears didn't separate who it was. But we still have to destroy the papacy, and that's going to happen a little bit later. So there's still the head of gold will still exist for a time after Gog's dominion is destroyed. That image is going to be lying on the ground waiting to be ground to powder. And that grinding to powder will involve the destruction of Babylon the Great. Now, I didn't intend to necessarily go through all of this in this order, but I think I will. I'm going to change up how I was going to go through this presentation. Since we've tried to make such a point of the image of Daniel 2 and the powers that incorporated into that, let's talk about Ezekiel 38. We'll go over the players of Ezekiel 38 and then maybe come back and make a few more points as we talk about Daniel 11 and 38 together. If you can remember the maps that we were looking at, confused my remote control. Sometimes maybe technology is not all that great. Just try to bring your mind back to some of those maps that we looked at earlier. Okay, the territories of Nebuchadnezzar's image. And then let's focus our attention on the players of Ezekiel 38. And what we'll find as we try to look at all of these things historically together in Ezekiel 38, we're going to find the territories start to match up a bit and even expand as well. Match up and expand. All right? So in Ezekiel 38, I know most of us have read this enough that I'm not going to read through the powers that are mentioned. Let's just talk about them. All right. Note on this chart, which I might have bumped the projector. It's a little bit out of focus for me right now. We've got Magog, Gomer, Meshach, Rosh, Tubal, Tagarma, Goma here, Persia, Egypt, Libya, and we've got this area in purple that's not included with any of the brown territories, which is a real key point. And there's a lot of reasons why I think that's that I can't go into, can I? I think there's a reason why Nebuchadnezzar's image nor Ezekiel 38 nations encompass this territory here. And maybe you can come up with your own reasons. I think there's a reason why this territory is not included in Nebuchadnezzar's image. And I think it's because they will be unable to take it. Physically unable because of the power that will be there. So, Magog. Historically, we know that there is plenty of evidence to tell us that where Magog is. The western border of the river Danube to the eastern border, the river Don. So here's the Don River, here's the Dan River. All of these areas in between are the territory of Magog. From Josephus and other historians, we can feel pretty confident of that. Territories known as Germany, Hungary, and some of those eastern Slavic peoples fall into that particular area. Rosh and Meshach. Is it me, or does that need to be focused a little bit? Just a little bit? You want to volunteer, David? I'm afraid to get in front of this speaker and have the feedback hit me. Yeah, just grab the front lens and turn it one way or the other, and we'll figure it out. There we go. All right. If we look at the identification of Rosh and Meshach, we know from the Encyclopedia Britannica that the name Russia is certainly derived through Russia from the Slavic Rus or Rosh. Now, where does that appear in the Ezekiel 38 Bible students? Where do we see Rosh mentioned there? Chief prince, right. So when you see that phrase in Ezekiel 38 in verse 2, the chief prince, that's the Hebrew phrase Rosh. So historically, the Encyclopedia Britannica helps us to understand that that is the most ancient name of Russia. Meshach and Rosh together, we know from historians such as Bokhart and others who have chronicled the Soviet Union even and others that these are ancient names for both Russia and for Moscow. All right. Here's another Easton's Bible Dictionary, which helps us on the territory of Meshach and relating to the areas between the Black and the Caspian Seas, an area that has become known as the Muscovs or Moscow. Tubal is an area in Russia today, a nomadic tribe associated with the Scythians. Along with Meshach, its name is preserved in its city, Tubal, and later founded by its descendants. Persia is mentioned in Ezekiel 38, and that's pretty easily identifiable for us today as Iran, right? Now it gets to be very interesting, doesn't it? Because we know we're starting to see some overlap with Nebuchadnezzar's image, aren't we? And I think this is where things get to be very important. There's only so many times Christ and the saints can overcome these powers in the last days. You know, if we really believe and have faith that our Lord and Savior is going to become a powerful king, why would we conclude that it's going to take him twice to destroy these powers, once in Ezekiel 38 and once in Nebuchadnezzar's image. It's only going to be one destruction. Or maybe we don't think Jesus is as powerful as we think he's going to be, the great commander. That's a simple thing. We know that. We know how powerful the rainbowed angel is going to be, the Lord. So if we know Persia is part of Ezekiel 38's dominion, and if we know it's a portion of Nebuchadnezzar's image, we can conclude that they are tied in together. Libya. We know where Libya is today, and I know that we look at what's going on there and we go, well, how's this going to end up? And I think sometimes, maybe I've got my own ideas, and maybe you in the audience have your own ideas of how Libya's current policies are going to work out. But I think the most important thing for us as Bible students is to know this. We know that Libya is a part of the Gog's dominion. We know it is working in concert with the king of the north. We know where they're going to end up. How the Elohim are manipulating things to bring that about, it might be a little bit more difficult for us to speculate. And I think it's enough for us to know where things are leading to. It's enough for us to know where things are leading to and be patient to watch whatever will transpire. I think we can be confident that whatever is going to happen in Libya and whatever we may have missed in the news since we've been here, that when it's all said and done, Libya will still be a country that is greatly aligned with the Gogian and Magogian powers. And I have no question in my mind that what is taking place now is going to further that alliance even more. We're going to have to be patient and see how that works out. Ethiopia is the next power that is described as being a portion of Gog's dominion. Now, we may disagree on this, some of us. And I am not going to present this next thought on Ethiopian Kush as being absolute fact to anybody, because I think that there's a lot of territory represented here. But I just think it's interesting that when you look at Genesis 2:13, Genesis 10, Isaiah 18, and Judges 3, we know that biblically Cush, which is where we get Ethiopia translated from, Cush really biblically has a lot of ground that it covers. We know from Genesis 2 that Cush is near the area of where the Garden of Eden was. We follow some of our scriptures, and we know that the Cushites migrated across the Arabian Peninsula. Moses' wife was a what? What kind of woman? Yeah, she was a Cushite. She was an Ethiopian woman. So, I mean, obviously they've migrated even into this area. And we have a country now not shown on this map, which is called Ethiopia today. Brother Thomas felt very strongly, and he may be right on this, he may be wrong, he felt very strongly that the Kush being referred to is what is referred on this old map here as Kushistan. What nation is this today?
Iraq.
It's Iraq. If he's correct, then we can see where all of the turmoil that's been going on the last 20 years there might be the Elohim working together, you know, as well to bring about, you know, a great result. And maybe we still will expect to see, you know, that power aligned with Gog at the time of the end. And maybe that's part of the reason why we've seen Persia meddling so much with what's going on in Iraq still today and trying to control things. But I'm not saying that the nation of Ethiopia today has nothing with Gog's dominion. Brother Thomas, that was his feeling. He really thought that the area that he knew in his day of Kushistan was the nation of Ezekiel 38 to pay attention to. Now, on the other hand, if it is that area of Ethiopia that we know of today in Africa that's mentioned, then we can be confident that the Lord, the Elohim, are going to be working to bring that to pass as well, that they will be aligned with that power. But if Brother Thomas is correct, then maybe the last 20 years of all this turmoil going on, we've been seeing how Iraq is being slowly molded into something that will be much more amenable to being part of this Gogian Confederacy in the time of the end. I kind of can allow for both points of view on that. But you might want to look at these quotes from Eureka, Volume 5, at your leisure on Brother Thomas's position. He really thought Kushistan was what we were looking at there. Gomer takes us into the Western European powers, areas today such as known as France and Brussels and Spain and Portugal. So the progenitors of the Celtic peoples who settled these large tracts of Central and Western Europe are also represented in here. And this is where I could never stick to my notes if I wanted to, and so I won't. I'll make mention now of something I was going to talk about a little bit later. Most of us are aware financial conditions are in such turmoil everywhere, and I know Brother Sid made a small mention of it yesterday, but I think it's worthy for us to pay attention to what's going to happen with this little country here, as well as all of them, Greece and Portugal with Spain. Those financial conditions in those countries, which are horrible, can we see where Gog might be their answer when the time comes? You know, they're an extremely stable country right now, and the U.S. can't bail them out. The United States' financial condition is in utter chaos. No help there. We can really start to see where Gomer is going to be beholden to the Magogian and Gogian powers. And so I think it's interesting to watch these things. Maybe they won't work out exactly as we think. Maybe we need to be, you know, careful with looking at modern history, because sometimes things change in a blink of an eye and our suppositions cannot work out. But if Ezekiel tells us that Gog comes to take a spoil and Tarshish says to him, "Art thou come to take a spoil?" You know, we can see where the financial chaos may be leading to us, and Russia being desperate to maintain her own stability, wanting to get into a land where they can control commerce and trade, and their confederates, who maybe they will be bailing out in the near future. Togarma is also mentioned in Ezekiel 38, obviously, and we find here from Jesenius that it is a proper name of another northern nation, a country that sprung from Gomer, the Crimeans, and we know that it's an area of Armenia today that is very much looked for. And I thought I had an arrow on there. I thought one day I did. But right here between the Black and the Caspian Seas are the areas of Togarma. Now, for those of us who are a little bit older, and maybe not so young, now we think back to, you know, 1989 to 1991, and maybe we can look back now a few decades later and realize why it was so important for the Soviet Union to break up. Because there was a time where all of this territory was part of the Soviet Union. But Ezekiel describes them as different fellows, all confederate in one purpose. You know, there was a time where they weren't all one, but now they are different powers. Oh, I just said that wrong, didn't I? They were all one, now they're separate entities, but they're going to unite together for a particular purpose. All right, the other players mentioned in Ezekiel 38, Sheba and Dedan, the Saudi Arabian Peninsula. And obviously, now I think we start to see why this territory was never controlled by any of the powers of Nebuchadnezzar's image. Because Ezekiel shows us that they're not part of the Gogian Confederacy. They are those who stand up to it and say, "Art thou come to take a spoil?" They will stand up to Nebuchadnezzar's image, if you will, along with, Ezekiel tells us, the merchants of Tarshish. Now, I could go through a lot of slides like this that I think are really interesting of how Britain has in past times used the symbol of the lion to himself, Tarshish and the young lions thereof. Just look at Ezekiel 27. Let's take a quick look at that, because I think there's a verse here that can help us feel confident that we're right in identifying Britain as the Tarshish power. Ezekiel 27, verses 12 through 13. Tarshish was thy merchant by reason of the multitude of the rich of all kinds of riches, with silver, iron, tin, and lead they traded in their fairs. Javan, Tubal, and Meshech, they were thy merchants. They traded in the persons of men, in the vessels of brass in the market. Well, verse 13, I didn't really need to read necessarily for this point, but in verse 12 we find out that one of the metals that are precious to the Tarshish power is tin. And in the upper left-hand corner of this particular slide, you see what Britannia means. Britannia means the land of tin. So maybe that's an excellent connection for us to make with these particular Tarshish powers. And these are just some posters that Britain had used through the ages to advertise for help in their conquest, their battles. There has been, over the last 20 years, a great reorganization of powers taking place, I think. Britain and the United States and all countries, their interests are being slowly gathered into the Middle East. Things have been changing. There was a time where you would never have imagined, you know, Britain or the United States. And I think, Sid, you had this chart, didn't you? There is a time where we never could have imagined all this U.S. and Britain interest in this territory. But because of the two Iraq wars, things have been reorganized in such a way that when we talk about Sheba, indeed and now, the merchants of Tarshish, the Elohim have brought them to that point where they can say, "Art thou come to take a spoil?" God has moved them into position. And that should be encouraging to us to realize that certainly, you know, the time is near. So we look at all of this and we see Nebuchadnezzar's image was here. Rome, we know their dominion went all the way into Europe. Think back to that map that David traced out for us. Rome was there. The head of gold was there. We had the Persian represented here. The arms, the breast of silver, the Greek Empire was there. All of these territories that were representative of those dominions joined together. And so I think we can see that Nebuchadnezzar's image in Ezekiel 38, we're dealing with powers that are indeed identical. All right, let's take this information now that we've gone through here, and let's go to Daniel chapter 11, and let's see if we can't start to bring some things together here. Right. Going back to where Brother Sid had us yesterday, and he went through some of these verses, let's try to go back through them again. You know, there are brothers and sisters who feel very strongly that these six verses in Daniel 11, from verse 40 to 45, really don't relate to anything that we've talked about yet. And so, you know, and with the spirit of meekness and politeness, we've got to find a way to reason that out together. And hopefully, by tracing through the importance of Nebuchadnezzar's image, we've been able to, you know, to give you that we've got to fit things in with the blueprint here. And I'm going to try to give you some thoughts as we go through here that why I think some of our brethren are being faulty in taking these four verses 40 and 45 and saying, well, 1917, that was it. Daniel 11 was over. As I said earlier, that would be totally contrary to every other vision that Daniel had seen, where all of his other visions take us to the kingdom of God. It would be then the only vision that doesn't, which would seem to be quite odd, wouldn't seem to fit the pattern. Clearly, Daniel 11 is a partner to the vision seen in chapter 8, which showed us the development of the four-horned power there of Greece. And Daniel 11 starts with that. So I can't see in Daniel's mind any other way that he would have thought, whoever these powers are that are coming in my future, it's the same prophecy. So Daniel 8 and Daniel 11 certainly, in my mind, are companion prophecies. All right. Verse 40, and these verses, Brother Sid read yesterday, and we'll talk about them. Maybe we'll overlap some information. Maybe we'll talk about things a little bit different. When we get to verse 40, we've got three powers that are being spoken of here. And maybe this is where some of our confusion comes from, because maybe some Bible students have trouble understanding the three here. Throughout Daniel 11, we've got the conflicts being described between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids, the king of the north and the king of the south. But if we pay attention in Daniel 11, in verse 36, we have for a period of time, 36 through 39, the king of the north and the king of the south disappear from the narrative. All of a sudden, for just a short period of time, they're not talked about. All that's talked about is this one king, which Brother Sid told us yesterday, and rightly so, relates to this king in Constantinople, this Roman power. Historically, we've gotten ourselves to a point in time to where Rome actually was in control of both the king of the north and the king of the south for a time. And so that would be why in those verses the conversation of the king of the north doing this with the king of the south and vice versa disappears, because Rome was controlling both for a period of time. And that would certainly explain to us why. I need a paperweight. Why the narrative doesn't have them for a short period of time. So we have Constantinople described in verse 36 as the king. That power is going to be described in verse 40 by the pronoun him. Okay? Because over a period of time, Rome was eventually driven out of Constantinople. Brother Sid took us through this. In 1453, the Turks finally succeeded in taking Constantinople, Istanbul. So now, while the king of the north and the king of the south, as they were talked about through verses 1 through 35, still haven't reappeared back on the scene historically, you know, the Turks then became that king of verse 36. Remember, not races, but territory. So while 36 through 39 of chapter 11 was showing us the history of Rome and Constantinople, by the time we get to verse 40, they've been replaced by him, the him of verse 40, the Turk. They now are ruling in Constantinople. But now we get to a point in time in the narrative in verse 40 where for a very short space, the players of the king of the north and the king of the south come back into play. And think back to Brother Sid's comment yesterday, and I want to make sure I get this right. I might even need you to speak up and correct me if I don't say it right. You had on there that one slide that showed us that historically there was that Constantinople was not under the dominion of the king of the north. And that's a really good point. So I learned a very valuable lesson on that. I don't know why I missed that throughout my whole studies of the Bible. So that I think that helps us with verse 40 to understand that why him could be a third player. Because when we read through this in the King James Version, it sounds to us, first of all, like, well, at the time of the end, the king of the south shall push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind. If we read it too quickly, we could think this is the king of the north and the king of the south coming against each other. But both of them are moving against the power described by the pronoun him. Now, for somebody like me who struggled with English and prepositions and subjects and things like that, that can be sometimes difficult. But if we take our time, we can see that there's a third entity described here. It's this power in Constantinople, which isn't called the king of the north here, because historically they weren't, as Brother Sid told us yesterday. So verse 40 then, at the time of the end, we've already learned from chapter 8, this is a time that will end with the sanctuary, the temple, being vindicated, being cleansed, being made righteous. So we know it's a time frame that has not concluded. At the time of the end, the king of the south shall push at him, and let's just call him Turkey for the moment. That would be the easiest way to describe that, right? Turkey. And historically, Egypt began to push at Turkey around the era of 1829 to 1838. Mehmet Ali was pushing against that power in Constantinople and began a revolt against the Ottoman Turk. Britain took up the cause on behalf of Egypt and the King of the South in 1882 when they came into the region. And from 1882 to 1917, pushed very forcefully against that Constantinople power. So much so that during the era of World War I, and we all know this from our history classes, the Euphratian power, the Ottoman Turk, dried up. And they were pushed back to where, instead of controlling all of Mesopotamia, all of this Middle East power, they were pushed back into where they are today in the nation of Turkey. Their interest in Europe were also pushed back. Then we have the king of the north coming against him like a whirlwind. Now, we've already spoken about Ezekiel 38 and their players. We see in verse 43 that this king of the north power is a power that the Libyans and the Ethiopians are in concert with. I think it's really simple common sense, isn't it, brethren? You know, if the time of the end is the same as the latter days, and all of these eras end with the kingdom of God, how many times are the Libyans and the Ethiopians going to be destroyed? Are they that powerful that they've got to be destroyed with the king of the north and then also with Gog by Christ? Or is he going to do it just once? So the king of the north comes against him like a whirlwind. Young Bible students, and maybe some older ones, we do sometimes hear from brethren who we have great affection for, who feel strongly that really what is being talked about here is how Turkey was able to come against the Holy Land like a whirlwind. However, the facts of history do not come close to supporting that conclusion. The Ottoman Turks took centuries, to be able to finally overtake Constantinople. And then when they did, their move into the Holy Land and into Egypt took over 100 years. Is that a whirlwind? Is that a great storm? Not by any stretch of the imagination. It took some 60 years for them to move. After they had taken Constantinople, it took some 60 years to get into the Middle East. People are going to be listening to the tape and go, "What in the world happened there?" We almost lost the screen. It took some 60 years for the Turks, after they had taken Constantinople, to get into the Middle East. And when they did finally push down into the Middle East and got into the glorious land, Edom and Moab did not escape out of their hand. The facts of history are clear. When Turkey came into the Middle East, not just Israel suffered, Edom and Moab were under the complete domination and control over Turkey. So the facts of history do not fit at all. Once getting into Israel, it took them another 40 to 50 years to get into Egypt. All right? So the history just doesn't seem to work out there for us. But does the parallel here between Daniel 11 and Ezekiel 38 seem to work out? I think it does. Verse 40 says the king of the north comes like a whirlwind. When we look over at chapter 38 of Ezekiel, in verses 8 and 9, we see that the Gogian Confederacy is there described as coming as a storm. Are they good synonyms? I think so. A whirlwind and a storm. Ezekiel 38, 8 and 9. After many days thou shalt be visited. In the latter years thou shalt come into the land that is brought back from the sword and is gathered out of many people against the mountains of Israel, which have been always waste, but is brought forth out of the nations, and they shall dwell safely, all of them. Thou shalt ascend and come like a storm. Thou shalt be like a cloud to cover the land, thou and all thy bands and many people with thee. Both the king of the north and Ezekiel then come like a great storm, like a great whirlwind. The Turks never were very fast at anything. Go ahead, Al.
Would you mind reading verse 40 of Daniel 11 and remove the pronoun from the church?
All right, we'll do that. We'll read verse 40 and just to assert the identities. And at the time of the end shall the king of the south, Egypt and Britain, push against the Ottoman Turk. And the king of the north, Russia, shall come against the Ottoman Turk like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships. All right. And I think that maybe that does help. And it's still very important to note that the whirlwind movement that is first described here is towards that area of Constantinople. And that certainly was not something that was historically a whirlwind, if the answer here is the Ottoman Turk. And I say that as I would to my friends who have that opinion, and have, some of them are very close to me, that look, the facts of the history just don't support that conclusion. There was no whirlwind movement. All right, let me find my notes here and get back to this. Verse 40 says that the king of the north comes with chariots and horsemen and a great many ships. Now, we won't repeat some of Brother Sid's comments there. I thought they were very good on how Russia has once again built themselves up. But in Ezekiel 38, we find similar language that is used there. In Ezekiel 38, verse 4, and then verse 15. I will turn thee back and put hooks into thy jaws, and I will bring thee forth, and all thine army, horses and horsemen, all of them clothed with all sorts of armor, even a great company with bucklers and shields, all of them handling swords. The 15th verse. And thou shalt come forth from thy place, out of the north parts, thou and many people with thee, all of them riding upon horses, a great company and a mighty army. So Gog, the king of the north, the time of the end, the latter days, they all come with these great horsemen, many chariots, a great army, like a whirlwind, like a storm. Now, when we start to fit the pieces together here of Daniel 11 and Ezekiel 38, it's really important to get also the timing of events down, because it's not really easy. I mean, I'm trying to compare Ezekiel 38 with Daniel 11 as we go through this, but really, I think it's best for us to understand that as we're going through Daniel 11, Ezekiel is going to be looking at this from a different perspective. Daniel's going to look at the king of the north coming into the land from the perspective of an army that comes forth out of the north and simply comes into Turkey, then through the Holy Land, into Egypt, and then turns back in to Jerusalem. Where Ezekiel only has the perspective, well, you're going to come forth out of the north parts, but I'm going to have to turn you back after you've come forth out of the north parts to get you back into the Holy Land. So I would, maybe to make it easier for you, particularly some of the younger Bible students, think about Ezekiel 38 and verse 4, where it says, thou shalt ascend and come. Think about that as being something that happens about the area of verse 44 of Daniel 11. And that might be something you pencil in, not pen, all right, till you believe it to be true yourself. But that might be a good place to put those thoughts together. Daniel tells us that the king of the north, then after moving upon this Ottoman power and overflowing it, and I think it's important that not just coming against the Ottoman like a whirlwind, overflows and passes over, is the way that verse ends. Overflows and passes over, and then entering into the glorious land, and many shall be overthrown. Now, I didn't read countries there, as it is in the King James. I just read, many shall be overthrown. You'll notice it's in italics there. And I think the focus of that, everything there in verse 41 to the colon there, is the initial problems now that come upon Israel. Okay? He enters into the glorious land, and many are overthrown. All right? Many are overthrown. And then verse 41 tells us that when this initially happens, Edom, Moab, and the chief of the children of Ammon escape. All right? Once again, that doesn't mesh at all with what the Turks did. When they came down, Edom, Ammon, and Moab suffered just right along with the glorious land and that movement down equally. There was no escaping. In fact, they never escaped. They came down and took them as quickly as they took Israel, which was pretty slow. Maybe quickly wasn't the best adjective I could have chosen there. It was a pretty slow process, but they took them all at the same time. There was no escaping. At this point, then, as Europe and Russia have united together, as fits with Daniel 2 in Nebuchadnezzar's image and what's taking place here in Daniel 11, we come into a time where Israel's troubles are beginning. Their nation has been entered into, many have been overthrown, and now we see their troubles coming to pass. It is important to note that initially Moab does not fall into the northern invader's hand. And that helps us with the answer of why Ezekiel says what it... Why Ezekiel? My brain is not following my voice. My voice is not following my brain. One of the two. Why Isaiah describes this about Moab in chapter 16 and in verse 4. Let mine outcasts dwell with thee, Moab. Be thou a covert to them from the face of the spoiler. For the extortioner is at an end. The spoiler seetheth. The oppressors are consumed out of the land. Isaiah then is seeing the same event from another perspective. Daniel describes this great company coming in and overflowing the land, but Edom and Moab and Ammon for a time escaping. And I say for a time because Daniel's perspective here, how he's viewing the events, later Isaiah 63 is going to see another form of events where Edom and Moab and Ammon are not escaping any longer. But at least initially they are. This will allow for Israel, many in Israel, to flee, at least temporarily, into the land of Moab. Now, younger Bible students, a lot of times you might hear Christadelphians say here, well, the Septuagint doesn't really render this verse this way. It kind of gives things different that Moab's not going to be this outcast. Well, I'm going to tell you very strongly that I don't put a lot of faith in the Septuagint on this verse. Okay? In fact, I'm downright offended that this verse would even be looked at with any credibility by any Christadelphian, because not only does the Septuagint not translate Isaiah 16 to the Hebrew, but turns around and calls our Lord, instead of a lamb, a lizard. Instead of sending the lamb to Mount Zion, the Septuagint says, send the lizard. Aren't you offended by that, brethren, that your Lord would be called a lizard? And yet some of us Christadelphians might want to latch onto that and think, well, no, we like the Septuagint rendering better of this. Now, I think my voice got into a little sarcasm there, and I really don't want it to, because I don't want our disagreements to be viewed as that way, so I shouldn't have done that. I want us to approach these things with earnest heart, so I shouldn't have let that sarcasm creep in. But It bothers me that we will look at that translation that calls our Lord a lizard and give it any credibility at all. I'll leave that there. At this point in time, we might see how Zechariah 10 begins to make some sense to us as well. I'm probably starting to tread on some of Scott's stuff here for tomorrow. Zechariah 10 and verse 10, I think I'll try to read this one quickly, maybe even before y'all can get it turned up. Well, maybe not. There's going to come a time where Zechariah then will describe that the outcast of Israel, this will happen. I will bring them again also out of the land of Egypt and gather them out of Assyria. And I will bring them into the land of Gilead and Lebanon. Place shall not be found for them. You know, Zechariah describes a second Exodus happening. And I think you can start to see where Zechariah is meshing with Daniel here. If the king of the north is coming into the Holy Land, many are passing over, the country's taken. Where are the Israelites going to flee? Well, Isaiah says into Moab. But Russia's moving into Egypt. Where are some of them going to continually flee? Some of them who might be fighting, they're going to be backing up into Egypt. And they're going to need to be brought out of there again. When Gog then turns, as is going to later describe to us in verses 44, and moves back into Edom and Ammon and Moab, and then will take charge, where will some of those Israelites that have been in Moab go to? Well, they're going to be forced to go further into Assyria and have to be brought back from those countries. So Israel will be passed through and defeated. And while this may be described as the beginning of the Armageddon phase, the conflict of which all nations be gathered, all nations being gathered together into Jerusalem has not properly happened as of yet. I got to slow down a minute. Those of you who know me best know that when I start getting excited, that's when I start making up words. And I want to be careful of that. I already alluded to this, but the next thing I had in my notes is I want you to understand why Daniel 11 could describe something entirely different than Isaiah 63. Daniel's going to describe Moab, Ammon, and Edom escaping, but clearly later on Isaiah 63 in verse 1 is going to see a great slaughter that's then going to happen. I think what this tells us, brothers and sisters, is that the king of the north's immediate concern is not Israel, but getting into Egypt for some reason. You know, and I think that's where maybe some of the financial concerns will come in. They need to get into Egypt. They've got to control that center of commerce and trade. Whoever controls the Suez controls the treasures and the gold of Egypt. That's their initial thrust. And that's why Daniel describes this push in the way he does. It's not until later that the tidings will come out of the east and the north that the king of the north will have to turn and ascend into the Holy Land and go make away with many who are then coming against them. And then why Isaiah 63 will follow with this remark for the March of the Rainbowed Angel, which I'll only read it and let Brother Scott get into this if he has time or desires to tomorrow. Who is this that cometh from Edom with dyed garments from Bozrah, this that is glorious in his apparel, traveling in the greatness of his strength, I that speak in righteousness, mighty to save? So, though Edom escapes for a time, they will suffer the battle eventually. Verse 42 of Daniel 11. The Holy Land has been entered into, Edom and Ammon and Moab have escaped temporarily, but this country does not escape. He shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. But he shall have power over the treasures of gold and of the silver and over all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be at his steps. Synonymously, Ezekiel describes the Libyans and the Ethiopians being a portion of the Gogian Confederacy. Now, I mentioned when we started on Daniel 11 how that it's interesting that the personages of the king of the north and the king of the south disappear in the narrative in verses 36 through 39. Pay close attention here to verse 42 and 43. Egypt is not called what in these verses? Not called the king of the south. This is a really crucial point. It's crucial because Daniel was shown in this chapter then a history that would see Egypt for time being the king of the south. But then when we get to the time of the end, a portion where Egypt will go from being the king of the south to not being the king of the south. In other words, Daniel's prophecy stretches beyond the careers of the Ptolemaics and the Seleucids. And I make that point to you, brethren, because some of our beloved friends who say, really, this all came to pass and ended in 1917, they say it. One of their proofs is, well, the king of the south and the king of the north no longer exist, so therefore the prophecy has to end with them. But Daniel shows us that the prophecy goes beyond those careers. The land of Egypt shall not escape, not the king of the south. So the prophecy extends to a time where Egypt no longer can carry this appellation. They're described by a different manner at this point in time. They are no longer the king of the south. They are just Egypt at this point in time. They are simply known as Egypt. Isaiah 19 comes into play at this point in time. Isaiah 19 in verse 1. Burden of Egypt. Behold, Yahweh rideth upon a swift cloud, and shall come into Egypt. And the idols of Egypt shall be moved at his presence, and the heart of Egypt shall melt in the midst of it. And I will set the Egyptians against the Egyptians. Maybe we're seeing a bit of this now. We'll see how the Elohim continue to work. And they shall fight every one against his brother, and every one against his neighbor, city against city, and kingdom against kingdom. And the spirit of Egypt shall fail in the midst thereof, and I will destroy the counsel thereof. And they shall seek to the idols, and to the charmers, and to them that have familiar spirits, and to the wizards. And the Egyptians will I give over into the hand of a cruel lord, and a fierce king shall rule over them, saith the Lord, Yahweh of hosts. Now, I'm seeing where the time is, and I really want to try to end on time, so let me give you some pencil notes here. And like I've said, don't put it in your Bible in ink until you believe it to be true yourself. These phrases, the cruel lord, the fierce king, look at Deuteronomy 28 and verse 50 and Daniel 8 and 23 at your leisure. And just note that it appears as if Isaiah is echoing back to those prophets. You know, Deuteronomy says that to Israel, you know, that, you know, there is this fierce power that's going to come over you, and they're going to come against Egypt itself. Daniel speaks of this cruel lord, this fierce king as well. Isaiah and Daniel in Deuteronomy appear to be in concert in their descriptions of this confederacy that comes into the land in the time of the end, in the latter days. It's a fierce king, a cruel lord, who Deuteronomy describes as a nation that flies as swift as the eagle. All right. This point in time, we hit verse 44. The Armageddon conflict will begin in earnest when all nations will be gathered together into Jerusalem. Tidings out of the east and out of the north, trouble the king of the north, the Gogian confederate, see? The power who is the king of Rome, the king of Greece, the king of Persia, the king of Babylon, the king of Assyria. Therefore, he shall go forth with great fury to destroy and utterly to make away many. And he shall plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas in the glorious holy mountain. Yet he shall come to his end, and none shall help them. We said it before, but this is why Ezekiel 38:4 describes Gog as needing to ascend and to come and cover the land like a cloud, because he's in Egypt when this happens. He came forth out of the north. He came through the Turkish power, through Israel, but he got to Egypt to secure his financial fortunes. But now, to keep those financial fortunes, he has to turn because of the tidings that come forth out of the east and the north, which we believe will be the tidings of the Tarshish and Sheba, indeed in powers, and go forth and utterly destroy and make away many. Utterly destroy and make away many. This tells us that in the conflict between Nebuchadnezzar's image and those nations who are not in Nebuchadnezzar's image but are willing to stand up, the Tarshish and the Sheba and Dedan powers, that Gog will be victorious in that portion of the Armageddon conflict. They will not be deterred by the Tarshish powers, the tidings out of the east and out of the north. And possibly the tidings out of the east will come from the rainbowed angel. We'll leave that to Brother Scott to touch on if he wishes, if he has time. But it will be at this point in time that verse 45 tells us that now comes this true and horrible trouble for Jerusalem. Because now will the king of the north plant his tabernacles between the seas in the glorious and holy mountain. Zechariah describes this as well in chapter 14. And I hate it when I don't stick to my notes because I have no idea where I'm at right now, but we're gonna do just fine. Zechariah 14, verses 1 and 2. Let's take a look there. I know where I want to take this to, so we'll get there. Zechariah 14, 1 and 2. Behold, the day of Yahweh cometh, and thy spoil shall be divided in the midst of thee. For I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken, and the houses rifled, and the women ravished, and half of the city shall go forth into captivity, and the residue of the people shall not be cut off from the city. Note that Zechariah prophesies here that all nations will be gathered to Jerusalem to battle. Not something that has happened hitherto for. Have all nations been gathered to Jerusalem as of yet to battle? Surely not in AD 70, as some might suspect. All nations, they haven't been there. The city will be taken, and then half of the city, or half of the people, you might want to pencil a note there, half of the people will go forth into captivity. It's described here in verse 1 as the day of the Lord, the day of Yahweh. Now, I have a note in my Bible which I've put in here in ink. I've highlighted the note because I think it's an important one. And young Bible students, this is something you're going to have to make up your mind on which perspective you agree with. There are some Bible students who suggest that Zechariah 14, 1 and 2 is over and done with. It's been fulfilled. The day of the Lord's come and gone. Malachi chapter 4 and verse 5, though, uses the same phrase and I think clarifies for us very clearly that that time has not come and proves it without a shadow of a doubt. Malachi chapter 4 and verse 5, Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. So Malachi says that Elijah will be sent forth to Israel before we get to verse 1, if you will, of Zechariah 14. Before the day of the Lord, Elijah's been sent to them. So this is really encouraging for all of us. It certainly shows us that Zechariah 14:1 can't happen before a very important event for each and every one of us in the Lord happens. And what's that? The resurrection. The judgment seat. Because Elijah will be sent forth before the great and dreadful day of the Lord. And he will begin his work. Go back to Daniel and maybe finish off with a thought here in chapter 11 to chapter 12. And then maybe it'll be a good time just to stop and let Brother Scott pick up with these events more tomorrow. The image having stood, we now have a power in the Holy Land that can be described as the King of Rome, the King of Greece, the King of Medo-Persia, the King of Babylon, the King of Assyria, the King of Russia, and any other term we want to give, the King over Europe, if we want to. I would have no problem with that. All of these powers now standing when verse 45 comes to its fruition. It is now time for Israel's redemption and rescue. And so without break, we go into the first verse of chapter 12. We know that in the Hebrew text, and even in the Chaldean, those portions of Daniel that's written in Chaldean, there are no chapters. We've got to know when the prophecy is done and when it starts. We've got to read through to the end. We find then that it's at the time the king of the north, Gog, Nebuchadnezzar's image, stands in the holy mountain, that Michael, the great prince, standeth for the children of thy people. At that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince, which standeth for the children of thy people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to that same time. And I think we'll stop right there, and we'll let Brother Scott pick up with what will happen to this confederacy of Europe and Russia from that point on, and what Michael will do to him. Thank you.